This ESPN Radio Daily Podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. To get a free quote on car insurance, call 1-800-PROGRESSIVE or visit progressive.com. You could save hundreds. Now that's Progressive. This is the ESPN Radio Daily Podcast.
Well, he won a couple of U.S. Opens. In fact, he topped the PGA Tour money list in 85 and 87 and in 88 when he became the first man to win $1 million in official money on the tour in a season. Curtis Strange, ABC ESPN golf analyst. It's The Herd on ESPN Radio. Curtis, you know, Tiger, for whatever reasons, has never been great opening day at the Masters. Is there an explanation for that?
No. I was shocked when I saw the stats this week, Colin. I think he shot 70 as his low score, and he's averaging over par, and he's certainly making up from that, isn't he, after that. But it makes no sense, and, you know, maybe just playing a little careful the first day. Who knows?
Well, you finished second in the Masters in 85. It's in an elevated experience for you guys on the tour. I do wonder, with his personal strife and this, is he going to be a little anxious or too anxious here in the first day?
You know, Colin, we've been covering this for 3 days now, you know, on the network, and we've been talking about it for 2 months ever since he announced his that he was going to play. And you know what? We all have our ideas on what's going to happen. We all have been speculating for months. Quite honestly, who the hell knows? You know, I'm serious. You know, he's a different animal in that he is, you know, extremely focused and mentally tough and a hell of an athlete. And when he's playing and playing a lot, he is by far the best player in the world. Now, can he overcome a 4.5 month layoff physically? And can he overcome a 4.5 month and current and in the future mental chaos? I don't know. If he does, if he played well here, he would be a I'm not going to say a better man. I think he'd be a much stronger man than I am, and I think you are. I don't see him playing really, really well, but, you know, it is Augusta National, and he has a great track record here. I guess bottom line, we're just going to have to wait and see.
Yeah, I agree though, Curtis. I think it's unrealistic to think he's going to go out there and blaze it and win this thing. What do you make of his pairing this afternoon?
Oh, I don't make anything of it. You know, they've been trying to make some storyline about that, but, who he plays with, it makes no difference whatsoever. I don't care if it's Phil Mickelson or, well, maybe Phil, because they have such just a rivalry there, but it doesn't make any difference. You know, when I played, I didn't say much. I was kind of into myself in my game, so it didn't make one bit of difference, but it will make a difference with those playing with him. They'll be anxious. They know what's going on. They've been reading the papers and listening to you guys for 4 months, and Jim Furyk said it best, Colin. Where I would not want to play today is the group in front of him because of the people.
Oh, that's a great point. Curtis Strange.
Yeah, I mean, the rush of people to get ahead of him, the rush of the crowds and the patrons. The movement would be tough to play in front of him.
No, that's a great point. Two-time U.S. Open winner, Curtis Strange via the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. Now, there's rumors of, I bet you're a golfer, so the best way I can just lay this out is there's rumors of how he's hitting and scoring. Okay, how's he hitting it? Do we have any video? Do we have any proof? When you watch him, do you think good stroke, comfortable, he's hitting it well?
Well, we don't know that either, because for those who play, Colin, do you play golf?
Poorly, yes, but I do.
Okay, so you wouldn't understand what I'm saying then.
Mostly no.
No, but what I'm saying is that he can hit all the balls in the world he wants for the last 6 weeks or 5 weeks, whatever he's been practicing. He can play well here in the practice rounds. He can hit the ball well warming up today. But that's a different animal than when you get under the gun on the first tee at 1:42 this afternoon. He's going to be anxious. To answer your question earlier, yes, he's going to be anxious. If he's not, he's not human. He knows that every one of these patrons out there, 35,000 PR, know what he's been up to, know what he's been doing, know that he's having a tough time with his wife, know that he's disappointed his kids, that type of stuff. So he has to be anxious. Now, how well he plays, we're going to have to wait and see, but, You know, I quite frankly don't know how. You know, he always looks good hitting it. He always looks good swinging it. Are you kidding me? But to be able to score, we're going to have to wait and find out.
Yeah. You know, Curtis, it's like you said earlier, a lot of players, some of you guys, Peter Jacobson's laugh, funny guy, a lot of you guys aren't. You were not a guy that was high-fiving. Every guy is different. As long as a guy is authentic, that's fine with me. I hear this whole Tiger new persona, this and that, and I think, boy, this is inauthentic. What do you make of the idea of a hanging out, high-fiving fan Tiger? What do you make of that?
Oh, I don't think that'll fit his personality. You know, even this week, they said Monday he was outgoing. Let's back up for a minute. He's going to be a humbled man this week.
Yeah.
And he will be a humbled man, I think, for a while, until he gets more comfortable on the golf course. And when you get comfortable in your surroundings, whenever or however that is, I think you fall back into your normal routine, which is focus, not acknowledging a lot of people. But I think for a while you'll see a bit of a different Tiger. But, you know, Tuesday and Wednesday they were saying he wasn't much different. He was walking with his head down, things like that. You know, I don't have a problem with that. He's the way he is. Arnold was the way Arnold was. Phil is the way Phil is. And thank goodness there's different personalities, because it would bore the hell out of all of us.
Yeah, no, as long as you guys are what you are, I don't have a problem with it.
Well, I mean, he is what he is. And, you know, the reason he's so doggone good is some of it's because he's like that. He's extremely focused. And I have to defend him in that regard. Now, could he be a little more open and open to the fans and to the people and to the press? Probably. I would still like to see him speak more to us on what's been going on, how he's feeling. I don't want to hear the dirty details. I just want to know how he's feeling and how Elon and the kids are doing, and, you know, really, truly, how you approach this week and the anxiety and whatever. So that's just the way it is.
Yeah. Hey, one non-Tiger question. I've always been.
Really?
Yes.
Do we have one?
I've got one, pal. This is it.
Okay.
I think. Listen, Arnie had a 3 or 4 year burst of his career when he won 5 of 7 majors, and Arnie's synonymous with great golf. But then when Jack came in, you know, Arnie was not as profound. Mick has had to largely play his entire career with Tiger hovering over him, and, you know, let's face it, he would have more majors. I never think Phil, whether he's likable or not, we never put him in the Arnie, Jack, Tiger class, and I always think, listen, when Jordan played, Barkley and Ewing, great players, didn't win a title. Are we not giving Mick enough credit, undervaluing him as an amazing golfer who just happens to play in the wrong era?
Well, isn't that truth with athletes throughout time? You know, if you got up, think about the ones that played against Hogan when he was winning in that 6 or 7 year period. Think about Nicklaus. Now, Nicklaus's career lasted longer than anybody else's as far as major championships. But think about the guys who played against Jack Nicklaus. My gosh, you know, they would have won. Trevino, Tom Waskoff especially finished second to him 4 or 5 times.
Tom Kite,
Ben Crenshaw. You know, all of that can be talked about throughout time, and especially now because it's so current, Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson and Ernie Els and Davis Love and those who have finished second or third to him many times in majors and tournaments. Yeah, you could say it's a bad time, but I think over time and in the future, Phil will get his due because he's won 30-some-odd tournaments, which is fantastic. He's won 3 majors. I don't think he's finished one of his majors. And, I think Tom will tell on his place in history, but right now he's pretty high on my list.
Yeah, 2-time U.S. Open winner, ABC, EBSPN's Curtis Strange. Great talking to you, Curtis.
Hey, good talking to you. Let's do it again this week.
All right, Curtis Strange.
To compare car insurance rates from top insurers in one easy place, visit Progressive.com today. You could save hundreds. Now that's Progressive.
ESPN.com senior baseball writer Jerry Krasnick. Jerry, what did you make of Big Poppy's outburst?
Well, I mean, I think sometimes these guys get tired of certain things, and he heard about this for the first couple of months of last year, you know, people questioning whether he had any bat speed left, whether he was finished, and you know, you look up at the end, and he wound up having a pretty nice season. I mean, he had a lot of home runs over those final 3 months. I mean, he finished with, if you would have thought that he'd finished with 28 homers and 99 RBIs last season, you know, a .462 slugging percentage, that turned out to be a pretty decent year. And, you know, to go 0-for-7 in the first two games, and have to hear about it again. I think it just hit a nerve with him. You know, David Ortiz is one of those guys who I think even when he's angry or mad or dropping epithets around is still considered a great guy. You know, he's not as big as he is and as physically imposing as he is. I don't know that he's that menacing a guy. So, you know, I give him a little bit of a pass on this. Let's see how he is at the end of April. You know, if he's still struggling and it's mid-May, yeah. But right now I think it's a little bit too early to sound the alarms.
Yeah, I don't think he's a bad guy either. I agree with you 100% on that. When I see something like this, when a guy blows up day three of the baseball season, this tells me that he's feeling that pressure, that even though you want to talk about how I did last year, that's still in the back of his mind, how badly he started last year, how he thought he was done. And when you blow up like that, my takeaway from this is that he's still feeling that pressure that he's got to succeed and maybe he's near the end.
Well, again, you know, he did drive in almost 100 runs last year, and I saw Nomar Garciaparra on TV today talking. You know, the one thing Nomar said is he might still be the old Ortiz, and I don't think he is. But, you know, he has had knee problems. He's had wrist problems. So if he's healthy, you know, he's still young enough. He's only 34 years old. You know, he should have three or four more good years in him. You're right. I mean, I think there's probably a little bit of a sensitive spot there, and you know, maybe he is feeling a little bit of insecurity, and he probably should have just kept his mouth shut. But, you know, I think he just perceives of, geez, if they're asking me about this two games into the season, you know, I'm going to get tired of this pretty quickly. And he didn't react properly, and, you know, given a day to cool down, he would probably admit that.
ESPN.com senior baseball writer Jerry Krasnick breaking down the latest stories with us. It's All Night with Jason Smith on ESPN Radio and ESPNRadio.com, presented by Progressive Insurance. Now, Jerry, like I said, we're 4 days in. The big deal has been David Ortiz. But so far through the first half of the first week of the season, what's caught your eye?
Well, I think the Giants getting out of the gate positively, you know, against Houston and really rolling through them in the first series have to give a lift to that team. You know, it's an older team. Not a great defensive or offensive team that is really off to an excellent start. So I think that's definitely a positive. You know, Jason Hayward, obviously, in Atlanta, whatever he does is going to be big. I mean, this kid is going to be a super player, and he's off to a tremendous start. Garrett Jones from the Pirates has three home runs already. You know, the Mets are hanging in there. They were... they won the opener behind Johan Santana, and then they battled back against Florida to tie the game 6-6 on Wednesday. So, you know, they're showing a little bit of life right now. You know, I think it's been an interesting first week. And obviously Roy Halladay, you know, I think on opening day for him to pitch the way he did sort of sent the message of, you know, he might be the guy that everybody thought was going to win 25 games this year.
You know, you bring up the Giants and the way they pounded the Astros their first three games. And, you know, we always look and see teams that start out and how can they continue this. But I'll tell you what, you know, what we've seen so far, this might finally be that San Francisco pitching as good as it's been. They put it all together this year, and suddenly it's spot insane and pray for rain again if you're playing against the Giants.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my question is just I did a story on this in spring training, and you know, Pablo Sandoval had, a 387 on-base percentage, and they're relying on a lot of guys like Edgar Renteria and Aaron Rowan and Aubrey Huff and, you know, Mark DeRosa. It's like every night is turn back the clock day there, you know. they need these guys to have the seasons they had 2 and 3 years ago, and I just don't know if that team has enough offensive firepower. They don't get on base. They don't walk at all. They don't steal bases. I don't think they're going to be a great defensive club. But, you know, any team with Lincecum and Kane and Zito, the way he ended last season, is a team that's going to be troublesome. So that's going to be kind of a fun division to watch. I picked Colorado, but, you know, the Giants certainly have enough pitching if they can get any kind of offense to be a threat.
He's ESPN.com senior baseball writer Jerry Krasnick. His latest on the Marlins-United double play combo on the front of the baseball page on ESPN.com. Jerry, appreciate your time. Let's look forward to talking to you all year long.
Thanks, Jason.
Golic needs some help.
I do.
He needs some tips because, Mr. Golic, we have thrown out two first pitches in our career.
Yeah.
one at Wrigley, one at Progressive Field, and neither time has Golic reached the plate.
Trying to throw the sinker too much.
So let's bring in a great catcher who caught Bob Gibson, among many others, and may have a few words of advice for you. Here's our buddy Tim McCarver from Fox with us on the Subway Fresh Take Hotline. We know it's baseball season if Tim McCarver is back and better than ever. Timmy, always a pleasure. What can you say to the big fella here, Mr. Golic, about what has clearly got into his head throwing out this first pitch?
Don't be ashamed. Don't be embarrassed. Stand in front of the rubber so you can get the ball to home plate in the air. That's what I would do.
I mean, that seems to be everybody kind of criticized the president when he threw his first pitch because he lobbed, you know, it went really high, but he didn't bounce it. And I guess that's it, right, Tim? I said, as long as you don't bounce it, you're okay. But I seem to bounce it every time. There's two of us out there.
Yeah, I think anything that you can do not to bounce the ball, whether you stand halfway, it doesn't matter. Nobody ever says you have to throw the ball off the rubber. You just can't go to your mouth when you're on the rubber.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. Stand halfway. That'll go over really, really well.
Timmy McCarver. They will have on the Fox Saturday game of the week, 3 o'clock Eastern, 2 Central this Saturday, they will have the Yankees and the Rays. And certainly the Yankees are always a topic of conversation, and they have been here the last 2 days, Tim. It started with the sort of war of words developed between the owner of the Brewers and the president of the Yankees about money. Essentially, it's all about money and competitive balance. And then we had Rob Manfred on this morning for about a half hour, the VP of Labor Relations for Major League Baseball, talking about all of their efforts in the direction, and I think legitimate, justified, and well-intentioned efforts in the direction of trying to create more competitive balance financially in Major League Baseball. You've been around the sport your whole life, Tim. How would you describe the current state of competitive balance in Major League Baseball right now as it pertains to money?
I think competitive balance is about the same as it was 60 years ago. I mean, the Yankees dominate. They dominated from 1949 through 1953. They won 5 straight world championships. And they're going to dominate probably again this year, even though they have competition from Tampa Bay and the Red Sox in their division. But, I mean, it's an old argument since revenue sharing became a topic 10 years ago. Do the mid-market and small-market teams pocket the money that are given to them by the Yankees? What I think the Yankees have given over $175 million over the last 8 years to small-market teams. Well, I mean, the Yankees are playing by the rule, by the rules, and I don't think they should be criticized as a result of that.
I completely agree with you on that. It's more about the system in place. If they were to come to you and say, you know, Tim, do you have something that will work better in this day and age? What advice would you give them?
I don't know. I'd give them any advice, but I mean, you know, the rules under which they're playing right now are the rules that by which they have to abide. And I really don't think small market and mid market teams have anything to say about it because, as I said, I mean, 60 years ago it was the same thing. I mean, the Yankees dominated. And obviously that's one of the big reasons they've won 27 world championships and 40 pennants. They've dominated, they continue to play by the rules, and I just do not think that there is any room for criticism there.
My apologies, Mike and Mike. Timmy McCarver again, he'll have the Yankees and the Tampa Bay Rays Saturday, Fox Saturday game of the week. 3 Eastern, 2 o'clock Central. All right, Timmy, what else? First week of the season, so obviously we're just getting underway, but give us a thing or two that you have seen so far that has stuck out as significant.
I like Tampa Bay a lot. I think they could overtake the Yankees this year. It's going to be difficult. A lot depends on their young pitching. I like the White Sox in the AL Central. Seattle in the West, obviously depending upon how fast Cliff Lee gets back. And, I mean, this Jason Hayward is for real. A home run, his first strike that he saw on opening day. The Phils are very good, obviously, the Cards and the Rockies. Those are the teams that have struck me in spring training. Really no surprises there. But San Francisco is a compelling argument in the National League West. Their young pitchers, I mean, they get 6 shutout innings against a team that doesn't have a good offense in Houston, but they get it from Barry Zito in a second start. Interestingly, I thought it was interesting that he started the second game of the season instead of Matt Cain. But San Francisco is very, very good with a better offense now than they've had to deal with over the past few years. So, you know, baseball has a way of engendering young talent. Aroldis Chapman will be up probably in the next month and a half. Maybe Steven Strasburg for the Washington Nationals and of course, Jason Hayward. When Henry Aaron comes out and says the things about Hayward that he did, you have to pay attention.
Well, I want to stay on Hayward. I mean, because there's so much talk about this kid. He's got 3 hits and 8 at-bats. He's got the home run. He's got 5 RBIs already. I mean, it's just incredible what he's doing and how much of it is natural because of how young he is. But the expectations, I mean, does he need to be shielded a bit from this? I mean, as you mentioned, Hank Aaron coming out giving such high praise, you have to wonder how much can this kid handle?
Well, I think that's the most impressive thing about him from what I've heard. You hear Bobby Cox talk about not only his talent, but as a 20-year-old, how he handles himself. I think it's a story with which everybody's familiar. His parents went to Dartmouth. He's obviously very intelligent. He was prepared for this at a very young age. And often that really is what distinguishes whether a young player reaches stardom. I mean, you can predict that from his talent. But if he handles himself well, that's the most important thing. Obviously, talent's the most important thing, but it's how you handle the talent. And from what I've heard, from what I've read, from all of the comments that the Atlanta players and other players have had, it's the way that this young man handles himself that gets everybody's attention.
It'll be awfully fun to watch, and Certainly we look forward to talking baseball with Tim McCarver throughout the season. Again, he'll have Yankees Rays this Saturday on Fox. Timmy, great to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Before you go, I've got one. This is my 51st year in baseball, and I was thinking about it before the phone call. I broke in Waterloo, Iowa in 1959, and you know who the home plate umpire was that night?
Who?
Brent Musburger.
No way!
That is a fact. Brent Musburger umpired the first game I caught in Waterloo, Iowa in mid-June of 1959. I'll leave you with that thought.
That is tremendous.
Wow.
Thank you, Timmy.
Thanks,
okay, Tim McCarver. Brent Musburger. We'll get him on and ask him about that.
Holy smokes.
I wonder if he said, play ball, you are looking live at Tim McCarver's first game ever.
I'd like to hear I call a strike. You know, and bring somebody up.
Folks, that's a strike.
Yeah.
ESPN, the magazine senior NBA writer Rick Bucher. Rick, who covered the Golden State Warriors for a long time in the late 80s and early 90s. Now, Rick, here's Don Nelson achieving something we didn't think a guy like Nelson, a record like he, would own. How has he been able to do it?
He's sly as a fox, and he has the constitution of a bull. Knowing a little bit of the lifestyle that Nelly continues to lead, it's extraordinary to me that he has held it together the way that he has. He's always, as Dirk Nowitzki said, he's a matchup master. He's such an enigma. He's such an interesting, complex character. As much as he likes to play the aw shucks guy, he's really a fascinating psychological case. There's no question that in terms of matchups and innovation, a tremendous, tremendous coach, has tremendous vision. There are other sides of Don Nelson that have wrought such damage on organizations and individuals. It's breathtaking. But he's been a survivor through it all. And as I once told Chris Mullen, you know, there's a lot of dead bodies around wherever Nelly goes. This is before he hired him, and there's usually one in your chair. And that's the case. But Nelly has always found a way to survive. And more than anything else, he coaches a style, and he has a certain effectiveness, ability to make lemonade out of lemons that has created a longevity that has allowed him to win all these games. But, you know, at the end of the day, has never sniffed a championship, has never built a championship organization, and at times has been both coach and general manager. And so at the end of the day, when he says, you know, I'm a good coach and I don't deserve to be in the Hall of Fame, I don't know that he believes it or he means it, but I think that's probably about right.
Now, wait, you said in the beginning you don't believe how he's doing it because of the lifestyle he leads right now. Yes. What do you mean by that?
Well, he still likes to have a few pops. His weight fluctuates wildly. You know, he has three or four cigars a day. I mean, and he's been living this life for, you know, he's coming up on 70 years. He's been living it for at least a good 40. I mean, that's just to be able to beat on your body and then all the travel and stress that is involved in being an NBA coach. It's remarkable to me that that his constitution has kept him upright this long.
ESPN The Magazine's Rick Bucher is with us breaking down Don Nelson, who on Wednesday night became the NBA's winningest coach of all time. It's All Night with Jason Smith on ESPN Radio and ESPNRadio.com. Now, Rick, you covered the Warriors for a good part of your early career, a lot of Don Nelson run-ins, not really run-ins, but, you know, obviously covering Nelly the way you have. What's the one story that you could tell that would sum up who Don Nelson is?
Wow. I, you know what? I mean, the complexity of him is I don't know that there's, well, I, you know what? I suppose the one is when I first took the beat with the Warriors and I went into his office and I'd always wanted to cover the NBA and I went in and I said, hey, look, I wanted to just be on the level with everything, and I wanted to try to cultivate a relationship right from the start. And I said, you know, there's times where I'm going to ask you questions, and I know that you may not be at liberty to give me the answer. All that I ask is that you don't purposely lie to me. You don't steer me the wrong way. And I said it much more succinctly now. I must have babbled on for about 5 minutes, trying to express my sincerity, and I'm not asking for any favors. I'm asking that you you don't purposely send me in the wrong direction. And so I went through this, and when I was done, and he basically said, "Well, you know what? If I feel I have to lie to you, I'm going to lie to you." I went, okay, well, there we go. And so I really think that at the heart of it, that's what, like, you talk to any of his players, they know that Nelly will snooker anybody that he can, but he's pretty forthright about, I'm going to try to snooker you. And you know, you have a certain appreciation for a guy like that. You don't trust him, you know, and you don't trust his word, but you know right from the jump you're not supposed to. So there's a really bizarre sort of honor in that, and you know, I if anything could sort of capture what Nelly is all about in my mind, that's it.
He's ESPN The Magazine senior NBA writer Rick Bucher. Rick will stop by with us tomorrow after the Lakers and the Nuggets and break down how the West was won or how it's still up for grabs. Rick, until then.
You got it, Jason.
NFL Network's Mike Mayock will be watching Jimmy Clausen's workout. Former NFLer, played at BC. Mike, when are you going? When is that workout?
As soon as I hang up with you, I'm heading out, and the workout is tomorrow morning at Notre Dame.
How long will it go? What will he do?
He still has some of those toe issues, so all he's going to do is throw the football. I anticipate a normal scripted throwing workout of somewhere between 50 and 65 throws. He's working with Mark Trestman, who scripted a lot of this stuff before. Golden Tate will be one of his receivers, and, you know, a lot of the NFL community will be there.
Do you believe, Mike, you can elevate yourself in the draft with a good workout with you and a receiver?
you know what? The quarterback thing comes down to seeing the ball come out of their hands, because you can watch a ton of tape, and we've all kind of formulated our opinion of what this kid is as far as on the field. And now you want to see the arm strength in person if you haven't before. And I just need to see it come out of his hand. I think I know what he is. It's not a question of, I'm going to shoot him up the board 20 spots or down the – I just need this – it's a cross-check. And I'm not a big believer of men in shorts. You know, I want to see you play on tape.
Mike Mayock joining us, played in the NFL, NFL Network analyst. Okay, when I want to get on record, every analyst has a different feeling on the quarterbacks. Trent Dilfer likes Colt McCoy, and it seems to me that Mel Kiper likes Clawson, and who doesn't? Todd McShay hates him. So give me your give me your sort of your lunch list here of who you like in order of quarterbacks.
Yeah, and this is an easy one this year, Colin, because it's not a deep quarterback class, okay? So there's really four guys that probably will go in the first three rounds, and they might go in the first two rounds because there's nothing very attractive after them. So I'm a Bradford guy. I was at his workout. I've done all the tape study. My only concern about Bradford is durability. And, you know, I heard what Trent says, and Trent watches some tape, so I give him credit on that side, but I really believe that even though he comes out of a spread offense, he has been under center. His footwork's good. He's a franchise quarterback. He's got a lot of learning to do, like all the spread quarterbacks, but he's going to go number one to St. Louis. After that, it's Clawson. Now, Clawson's got two issues. One is medical, and number two, which is more important, is what kind of kid is he? And there's all kinds of rumors out there, and everybody's doing their homework. And here's the interesting thing. Because of the McNabb trade, how far can Clawson actually fall? And, you know, you look at this thing, and if he doesn't go, for instance, number 9 to Buffalo or 10 to Jacksonville, it could get real interesting. You know, would San Francisco take him? They have two picks at 13 and 17. And Pete Carroll has his second first-round pick at 14, but I don't think he's going to be in the quarterback business given what they gave up for Whitehurst. So, you know, if he doesn't go 9 or 10, I'm not so sure. It could fall a little bit after that. And, you know, after him, you know, Tebow's picked up a lot of momentum since he kind of hit rock bottom at the Senior Bowl. People are buying into what he is. And I'm buying into the fact that 3 years from now, I think he's a starting quarterback. He's got a lot to work out, but he's got two redshirt years, in my opinion, before he's ready to go. I think he'll go in the second round. There's whispers of some late first-round stuff, but I think that's a little rich. And finally, Colt McCoy is only 6'1". He doesn't have Drew Brees' arm. I think he's kind of best case, a combination of Jeff Garcia, Rich Gannon. He's smart. He's a coach's son.
I like that Garcia. I think the Garcia thing's very accurate. That's what I see. I think he looks like Jeff Garcia to me.
And he does. Remember, Garcia was not a draftable kid. He spent a couple years playing behind Doug Flutie up in Canada before he got bigger and stronger and was able to play in the league. So because there isn't much behind these guys, and by the way, there's a kid from Fordham named John Skelton. I call him Flacco Light. He looks just like Joe Flacco, 6'5", 246. If there's any momentum after the top four quarterbacks, he's the guy that's kind of moving up draft boards because people think that there's something to build with there. Big arm, big kid, fairly smart. So he's a guy to watch out for in the third or fourth round.
All right, Mike Mayock joining us from the NFL Network. He is a Bradford, Clawson, Colt McCoy guy. We have to ask you about Tebow. Nike only gave him $300,000. I mean, they gave LeBron $93 million at 17, 18 years old. That tells me Nike, with all their contacts, they would know if Tebow was going to blow up. What do we make of Tebow and what, you know, I don't know. I he's going to play in the league. What do you make?
Here's my take on him, and everybody's got their own opinion, okay? I'm tired of the NFL taking chances on guys that are really gifted athletically that have been complete jerks off the field, whether it's six drug tests, whether it's beating up women, whatever. But, you know, they take chances all the time on guys in the second and third round with a checkered pass. Now, here's a guy that arguably is the greatest quarterback, greatest football player in the history of college football, arguably. His work ethic is unquestioned. His intelligence is good, and he's a winner. And why wouldn't you take a chance on a kid like this who's going to do everything you ask him to do, draft him in the second round, understand that he's going to be a project for a year or probably 2 years, But I'm betting on the kid. He's the kind of guy I want in my locker room. I want him in my huddle. And Colin, ultimately, you know, 3-4 years from now, I want him in the fourth quarter with the ball in his hands with a chance to win a football game, because I believe he's that kind of guy. And so I'm throwing the mechanical issues aside and saying he's going to work on that. He's got a strong arm. I'm buying in to the fact, and the reason Nike and they don't want to pay him any money now, because he could be a second or third team quarterback for 2 years.
Yeah. Mike, great talking to you. Good upside on the Bradford stuff. Thanks, man.
You got it. Anytime, Colin.